Once a month, we get to pick the brains of teachers at the University of Oregon in a segment we call Curious, Research Meets Radio. And this month, we're curious about, well, curiosity itself. You've heard the line, curiosity killed the cat. Well, curiosity used to get some people in trouble, too, official trouble. Our U of O guest this morning knows the history well. Vera Keller is an associate professor of history. Her specialty is the history of science. That history includes the history of curiosity, when it was encouraged and rewarded, and when it was not. Good morning, Dr. Keller.
Good morning.
It's great to have you on. I guess the very first question I wanted to ask of you is, when did you get curious about curiosity?
Oh my goodness. I think it was way back when I was still an undergrad. I was just trying to figure out where science came from. That was the big question that drove me. And one of the answers to that question was curiosity. Curiosity is such a big, important part of being a scientist today. And I knew, I had a sense, I had an inkling that it had a kind of strange past, because many of us have heard of these kind of weird collections of objects called curiosity cabinets. And so how to get from point A, from like collecting weird curiosities, to point B, with curiosity being one of the main motivators of science, which has such a big, important presence in our world, seemed to me a huge question that I really wanted to explore. And I've been exploring it ever since.
As I was reading a little bit about your background and some of these things, yeah, I'd heard of curiosity cabinets, and I guess for some reason I thought they were probably something that were owned by the wealthy of whatever time period who could collect these kind of things. But I guess ordinary people, you know, if you live on a farm and you have a calf that's born with two heads, that comes into your curiosity. Everybody had a curiosity cabinet, didn't they?
It's true. Curiosity cabinets were extremely widespread. Historians have studied them in very domestic, simple interiors. And also, they were often widely available because places like churches used to hang curiosities from the walls. They'd have like alligators suspended from the ceiling or reliquaries made out of ostrich eggs. So curiosities were on view in many public spaces as well as in people's homes.
How did people react to those back then, especially if they were in a religious climate or something, and again, back to the example of a two-headed calf or something, how did people think about those things back then?
Yeah, curiosities, they straddled this really ambiguous line for many centuries between being a portent and a wonder, a sign of a divine message, and just like a natural oddity. There was an idea that nature, which was kind of personified in the period, loves to play, that she was playful, and that curiosity could be just kind of sports of nature, just that she would want to play by producing a two-headed calf. But they could also be taken very seriously, and this is one of the darker sides of curiosity, that in a lot of warfare in the Reformation, for example, the Protestant Reformation in the 16th century, and continuing on through the 17th through the 18th century, when monsters, as they were called, were born, people interpreted that as kind of a heavy symbol that was used as propaganda against opposing sides. So they really got enrolled in some pretty violent conflicts as well. They weren't just playthings.
From the earliest human history, before human history even, people have been looking at the world around them. They would see the seasons. They would look up at the heavens and realize, without knowing why, but they would look up and they would see the movement of the planets and the stars, and that there was a reliability in that. At what point did we really start to move away from just observing as a curiosity and starting to think more about maybe the science behind all that?
Really around the 17th century, we call the long 17th century, meaning a little bit of the 16th and 18th century as well, is when people started to turn to particular experiments, to intervene, to test, to kind of play with nature, to see what would happen in different situations rather than observing it. And that's one of the big questions that I and all the other historians of science in my field try to still answer, is how did that happen? We don't actually quite know the answer to that. If you read history textbooks, they'll say, oh, the scientific revolution, and they'll give you a narrative. But really, historians are continuing to research that question, and pieces of the puzzle are still being put together, so it's an absolutely fascinating research journey. But I will take issue with your description of looking at things as a mere curiosity. When people observed the regularity of the heavens, they didn't think of that as a curiosity. When they looked at something that was irregular, that wasn't following the normal course of things, that was the curiosity. And that's why curiosities are so fundamental, from this turn to noticing regularity to looking out for things that are strange, or even maybe intervening to make things strange, like sticking something in acid or in a vacuum pump or some experimental situation. That is curiosity. It's when nature does not follow the regular course. You don't assume that things are just going to always be very simple and very unified, but you're assuming that things are complex and that there are oddities that might occur that require further questioning, further research. That's where curiosity comes into play.
It must be true that depending on how curious you are and how close you're getting to the realms of science, there must have been some tough times for people who were investigating things when they're in the context of perhaps a religious or political environment that didn't encourage that sort of thing.
That is true. Most famous case that people are aware of is Galileo being put under house arrest. People did get in trouble when they proposed theories that went against kind of religious doctrine at the time. And even more than that, there was wide social kind of concern about these experimentalists and what their interests were. We think of scientists, many of us today, with a lot of esteem. We forget that, particularly because they were associated with these weird little curiosities, back in the day when they started doing what they were doing, scientists were often figures of fun. And so the kind of funny things like two-headed calves or other curiosities that they were exploring got associated with them. And the rest of society thought, who are these people? What are they doing? Why are they wasting their time with your strange theories about infinite space or the fact that we revolve around the sun? And so scientists were very peripheral. They did not have positions in universities. There was no academic experimental science in the early modern period, the period I study. And so many of them were doing these in their own homes, kind of on the side as hobbies. They were really amateurs. So when you talk about curiosity cabinets being in people's own homes, a lot of the early, very important experimental scientists weren't coming out of universities. They were craftspeople, or they were noblemen amateurs or noblewomen amateurs back in the early days who were exploring these curiosities through their own collections. A lot of apothecaries had very important early collections that they did a lot of research in. And so it was all in all sorts of nooks and crannies that people were bringing out this new knowledge, not in kind of the dominant domains of power like the university or the church.
We're speaking today with Dr. Vera Keller, an associate professor of history at the University of Oregon. You can join our conversation by calling 800-838-3760 or emailing us at jx@jeffnet.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Jeff Exchange. Your questions about your curiosity about curiosity. I'm wondering that, you know, it seems quite often from our time and maybe all the way back through the centuries that any time there was a movement forward in science, there was an encouragement to be practical in it. And what's in it for me, and, you know, how can I make my life easier? Has that always been the case?
That has not always been the case. That's one of the major transformations that happened in this period, was this idea that useful knowledge is important. People used to think that science ought to be really separated from utility. It ought to be separated from the human world. It should be based in kind of abstract philosophical knowledge, because they were concerned that the interests, the financial interests, the personal interests that motivated people would kind of contaminate science. And to be honest, that is still an issue that we haven't solved today, the way that we really kind of police the boundaries between financial motives and the pursuit of science continues to be kind of an ethical quandary for us. And so people really try to create a sharp defining line between useful knowledge, what they would consider crafts, really, and knowledge that wasn't useful, which is why they called it the liberal arts, because it was free from any kind of mercenary or financial gain. And among the liberal arts was what we would consider now the sciences. So that was not the case. And in fact, curiosities, by definition, kind of were not useful. They were kind of just, as we say, just curious. And so it's interesting that curiosity played this big role in shifting nature, the study of nature, towards experimentalism, towards kind of hands-on investigation that we associate with modern science. Yet at the same time, they also belong to this idea of being merely curious, as of being not useful, that we don't associate with modern science. So there's a little bit of a conflict there. One of the ways that was resolved is that curiosity could be defined in many different ways. So one way you could define being curious is to be very diligent, very careful, so that when you're doing an experiment, you're extra curious about it, you're extra careful about it, you put a lot of labor into it. And so some people differentiated themselves as a good kind of curious, that they were curious in their researches, and that they were curious in order to help and benefit their fellow humans.
So curiosity in science, if I understand correctly, you know, began its split kind of in the Renaissance. Then until today, are they friends or enemies or frenemies? How would you describe that today?
I think if you talk to scientists today, a lot of them will say that curiosity are mostly friends, although there is sometimes a little bit of a tension between the way that how big science has gotten and how institutional and the kind of large corporate groups of individuals that have to work together to pursue large scientific programs and kind of individual curiosity, that there's a tension between individuals wanting to follow their own personal curious drive and fulfilling a large-scale research program. So maybe they're friends verging on frenemies right now. They were friends, good friends, for the 17th, 18th centuries, which was a big change from the purely enemy relationship they had had before.
I understand you did your dissertation on Cornelius Drebbel. Is that correct?
Yes.
You know, in the back of my mind, I knew something about his involvement with the invention of the submarine or early work on a submarine, but I didn't realize all of the other stuff that he'd done in his life or did in his life. Tell me a little bit about him.
So he's an example of someone from this era that really prized curiosities. He just embodied curiosity. He didn't go to school. He didn't know any Latin. He started out life as an artist. He was the brother-in-law of a rather famous artist. And he just started playing around with things and inventing things. And he just invented one amazing thing after the next. And so he invented, for example, an oven that you could set to a certain temperature. And mind you, this was even before thermometers existed. And it would keep itself at that temperature. So it's a form of feedback and thermostatic control. He's the first one to do that. It's kind of incredibly ingenious. So he had all sorts of ingenious inventions like that, spanning all sorts of different realms, from microscope development to developing a major scarlet dye that was the reason why the redcoats were red. It became the red dye for the next couple of centuries around the world. So really, there was no professional expertise, no domain that he restricted himself from. He just investigated everything. And that really personifies curiosity. You don't limit yourself. You just keep going. That gets you in trouble a lot of the times, but also leads to a lot of discovery when you bring together different areas of investigation that other people didn't bring together. And this was the function that curiosity had in kind of transforming knowledge, was bringing together all sorts of different skills and interests, and that's what Drebbel did.
Do we have people like him today, or has it become so specialized? I mean, I think of the pioneers in, you know, the computer business, some of the early folks who started Steve Wozniak and others like that. Are we? Do we have people that really are just Renaissance men, Renaissance women today?
I think if he lived today, Drebbel would most likely be a hacker. Yeah, he's someone who comes from the underground and takes down the people that are in control and try to innovate from the fringes. But it is true that today the way that our institutions have been built up, and this is something that people in the period, many of them dreamed of having. They dreamed of having institutions like this, like Drebbel's peer in England, Francis Bacon, that many people credit with inventing scientific method. Dreamed of having institutions like we have today, but they didn't necessarily recognize some of the problems that would come with that. And some of the problems are kind of the gatekeeping that we do, that we don't allow people who aren't already inside the gates, as it were, of kind of official science to have much of a say. There are these movements of citizen science, but what Drebbel was doing was far more profound. And what I find so amazing about that period of history and was the way that he was embraced in the period by kind of dominant academics. Even during his lifetime, professors were already publishing his writings in textbooks and teaching them to their students and having dissertations written on them. This guy who didn't go to school and didn't know the Latin, which every learned person needed to know at the day. So it was really an amazing kind of open-door period. We always assume that everyone in the modern period often assumes that we've been progressing and growing more and more open in our knowledge, and surely we're more, you know, egalitarian in our knowledge than people were 400 years ago, but that's not necessarily the case.
With the way science is so specialized today, is it hard to cultivate, I guess, what I would call uncommon geniuses? Obviously, you know, somebody like Drebbel had this amazing mind that was able to work in so many different directions. Are we doing enough, and maybe this is a little bit out of your area of expertise, but are we doing enough today to try to really encourage that sort of curiosity and experimentation in not just children, but even adults as well?
Yeah, I think that that particular angle of the question might be a little bit out of my domain of expertise, but there is an angle on it that I think about a lot, and that is the way we specialize and push knowledge forward towards this idea of having a niche, that each kind of intellectual academic is supposed to have like a little niche, a little domain, a little territory that they fully conquer. And there's a lot to be said for having a niche. It means you have real mastery of the details. But there is also a downside to that. It means that there's no one out there who's looking at the overall trend of research in all fields and trying to see, you know, where's it going, where's it heading, what should we want to do. We're all just working on our little niches and trying to figure out what's the next step, what's the empty territory just next to my niche, not kind of 50,000 leagues around the world as they would have been imagining it in Drebbel's time. So I do think this idea that we work in this like a small, confined territory, while it does lend us expertise and authority and mastery of our subject, it does mean that it's really hard to cultivate intellectuals who are thinking about our human body of knowledge as a whole and kind of overlooking the entire structure and thinking about it. And you did have people like that in Drebbel's time.
How has technology helped, especially back in the Renaissance and earlier times, maybe? I'm thinking of a couple of examples, telescopes and microscopes, where you could look big and you could look small. How does that push either curiosity or science forward?
Oh, it was absolutely huge to be able to take a telescope, and Drebbel was very early in using and further developing both the telescope and the microscope, and see another planet, or to look at a flea and see that it's a gigantic monster like a rhinoceros, was absolutely huge for giving ammunition to these experimentalists to say to those kind of dominant intellectuals, those academics who said, oh, the world has continued on its course forever, it's predictable, to say, no, there are many parts of this world that we had never conceptualized this way. We are revealing that below the surface of things, and expand it out very large, the world is utterly different than we imagined it. And that's why a lot of these scientists also wrote science fiction. This is also the beginning of science fiction, because it was seeing these new worlds that they saw through these optical instruments that they were able to imagine totally alternative universes and think about using science both as a way to get to an alternative universe, to create a new society with a totally unimaginable technology, and also to reveal that the world was very different from what they had previously conceptualized.
Our guest this morning has been Vera Keller. She is an associate professor of history at the University of Oregon. We've been talking about the curiosity of curiosity this morning. Dr. Keller, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.